Okay, so today we'll talk about completeness of intuitionistic BI as I nuts or not. Okay, we've been talking about these various notions of model. Right, and one of them was what is called a total pre-ordered resource monoid. So remember what this is? It's a monoid. Total just means it's a monoid as we know and love it. So basically it has a total multiplication operation. Hence the name total, although when we say monoid and nothing with it, then of course we always mean a total monoid. And this thing is moreover ordered, or pre-ordered to be precise, so it's equipped with a transitive and reflexive transition relation, if we will. So this thing is a form of Kripke model, and actually since this is a reflexive and transitive transition relation, it's an S4 model, or equivalently an intuitionistic model. Which is unsurprising. So basically what we see here is a combination of the semantics of linear logic with a multiplication operation for multiplicative conjunction and a pre-ordering to interpret the additive part, which is just intuitionistic logic. In the book, meaning Pim's book, the Semantics and Proof Theory, I believe, of Boolean of bunched implications. It is stated that this gives you a complete semantics for bunched implication logic as long as you exclude bottom. We have an exercise on the sheet that asks you to basically prove that you have to exclude bottom. So with bottom in the language, it's not complete. But without bottom, they say it's complete. I was saying also already something like 1.5 weeks ago or so that I've been spoiling my weekends trying to get this proof to work. I ended up writing an email to David Pym and received the very swift reply to the effect that, there's something wrong here and he's no longer sure that this is true. So the status of this claim here is very much open. So I'll just equip it with a question mark. So basically not only is the proof in the book not correct, I could see that much, but basically it's also not clear whether the result as such shows up. I don't mean this derisively or derogatory in any way, right? So, I mean, this happens. So there's realistic estimates to the effect that 40% of all published mathematical texts are wrong. And while I like to think that the percentage isn't quite that, I mean, many of you know that my own works contain errors, yes. So substantial ones if you're unlucky. So yes, this happens. And actually, I mean, nobody knows, right? I mean, the result could still be true. We don't know. Right, so what do we do? There were two things that one could do to fix this. One would be to retract this even further and go for BI without the whole join part, basically, without bottom, meaning the empty join, and without the binary join. That proof I believe is rather easy, and I believe that total pre-ordered resource monoids are actually a complete semantics for that further reduced logic. And for a time, I was planning to do just that reduced claim, which is actually fairly swift to prove and won't even take up the whole session. Or you change the semantics. It's clear that, I mean, in order to get a really satisfactory result, you'll have to change the semantics anyway, because, yeah, having this without bottom is fine and well, but I mean, you don't really want a language without bottom. So, and that has been done, so there's this proof in the literature about changing this. I mean, Tadeusz has mentioned this, right? You have to change this to a P anyway, in order to get completeness with bottom. We haven't proved this. I haven't read the papers that prove it. I'm not going to voice explicit doubts about it. I will in a moment illustrate why I believe it's actually necessary to move to non-deterministic. But of course, the proof that this works with partial put in there is, I believe, much more detailed than the one about the total pre-ordered resource monoids in the book. Is that correct? Galmisch and
Galmisch, Marie, and
Pimde, they prove this, right? For PPRM, right? Is that true? Or do they just do it for these topological things?
It's supposed to imply completeness with respect to PPRM.
Well, yeah. Okay, so there's, I mean, yeah, okay, so there's still this question mark here, but I mean, this question mark only means we haven't read the details. Partial means we give up the finiteness, universal definiteness of the monoid operation, and we can go one step further, and move to non-deterministic pre-ordered resource monoids. So now, the monoid operation is not just partial in the sense that it may be undefined, it also becomes non-deterministic in the sense that it may have several values. This is not a new idea. People have done this, and I think this, according to Tadeusz, I believe this notion does appear in the literature, if not under that name exactly, maybe, right? It is not terribly hard to say what such a thing might be if you know a bit of category theory. Okay, so a non-deterministic monoid would be a monoid in the Kleissley category of the power set monad, which is just the category of sets and relations. Of course, this still requires explaining what that means. So basically, we now have our monoid operation, which is now non-deterministic. That is, for each pair of elements that we combine, we get a set of elements of possible results of the operation. The set may be empty. This corresponds to this old partiality idea. So in this case, the operation is just undefined, but it might also be overdefined, if you will. So it might have several values. And we write x times y evaluates to z for z is an element of x times y. Well, actually, one might wonder whether it's even necessary to introduce new notation, so I've been just thinking this up. So, of course, the arrow just is element the other way around. Okay, so that's the structure of this operation, and of course we want the monoid laws to hold in some suitable sense. And, well, the sense is this. And now we have to be careful. This here is the normal monoid operation. So this gives me a set, and now I multiply a set with an element. Well, that means I just multiply that element with every element of this set here, and I take all the results together in one set, so I just form the big union. And I demand that this is the same as this, so that's associativity. Okay, and the other one's easier. Well, of course, this should be commutative, so that's just a straightforward equation between now two sets, right? So these are just two multiplications producing a set of elements from a pair of elements on each side. And here, well, now this would normally be a set, but we ask that it's just the singleton element X. Okay, so that's a non-deterministic partial resource monoid. Mm-hmm.
But you don't have a set of units, but a single unit, right?
I have a single unit. Yeah, that's currently the idea. Yeah, actually, yeah, right. If you were really playing it consequently, then the... do I want this? Yeah, but in the model that we'll end up constructing, there'll be a single unit. Yeah, actually, if I really insist that a non-deterministic monoid is a monoid in Kleisley of P, then yes, that becomes unpleasant, because then that we might have a set of neutral elements which on top of that might be empty. So I'm not sure I want to play with that. So okay, so just the multiplication operation becomes non-deterministic. The unit stays total and deterministic in the sense that there's only one definite unit. This is in tune with the transition from total pre-ordered resource monoids to partial pre-ordered resource monoids, where also you will not make the unit partial. You don't say this is something that has a unit or maybe not, but you definitely say it's something that has a unit. Okay, so that's our new semantics.
But it should mention that sometimes even in BI references, you see models, especially Boolean ones, where they do consider having marginal where you have a set of units, like in the Perlstein-Hanovich undecidability paper.
Okay, possibly. Can that set be empty, or?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make this unnecessarily general, right? So what happens when you make a semantics more general and you prove soundness and completeness? Well, if you make a semantics more general and you prove soundness, okay, then your life becomes harder. If you're the guy who proves completeness, then your life becomes easier, because the models that you construct need to have fewer properties, right? So the more liberal side of the semantics is, the easier the proof and the completeness proof becomes. Which is also, by the way, my sort of main quip about the currently most popular semantics of BI, which is what they call topological semantics. Basically, in the topological semantics, everything becomes even more non-deterministic. In this sense, basically what happens is they add another layer of power set here. So it actually goes to double power set. And this is called topological because, well, what's a set of sets? Well, a set of sets is a system of sets, for instance, a system of neighborhoods of a point, right? So, and actually they impose topological axioms that tell you that this system of sets should behave like the set of neighborhoods of a point. So, of course, that's even more general, and hence making the completeness proof easier, right? So we'll try to get away with this, and I cannot actually promise that I will, to be quite frank. The first thing that we should do, of course, is now, having defined these new models, I mean, of course, we have to adapt our semantics of formulas. So we have to now say what the clauses for evaluation of formulas are over these more general models. Well, there are only two types of, well, two clauses where this matters, where anything changes, and that's the one for star and for magic wand, right? Because those are the only ones that actually mention the monode operation. So, first of all, I have to be precise about what I mean by saying that M in such a model satisfies phi times psi. So I write the old clause and then amend it. So the old clause said that there exists N and N prime such that N satisfies phi, N prime satisfies psi, and N times N prime is under M, where you have to recall that we have the ordering the other way around than in Pym's book, right? So in our setting, extensions of formulas are upwards closed, not downwards closed. That's in order to stay in tune with the standard semantics of intuitionistic logic, where the order also goes upwards, right? So, yeah, that's the old clause. And the new one, well, this is now no longer well-defined, right? So this is now non-deterministic, so I have to say what I mean here. Do I mean some value or all values of n times n prime? And what I mean is some value. So I demand that there exists u such that n times n prime evaluates to u, among other things, and these things hold with this here replaced by u. So this is my clause for times. And well, this here could now actually be calculated. And what comes out of the calculation, which I haven't performed, just guessed, is this. Well, let's write the old clause first. So the old clause said, for all n, if n satisfies phi, then m times n satisfies psi. One should always think about this in terms of heaps, right? So, there are some fallacies involved in this, but if we think about this as a heap, say we say, okay, a heap satisfies phi magic one psi if and only if whenever I have another heap let satisfying phi and disjointly combined with m, then the resulting bigger heap satisfies psi. Okay. Now, I can this here again is no longer well defined, right? So I have to say what I mean by this, and what I mean is this. For all n and u, if m times n evaluates to u and n satisfies phi, then u satisfies psi. Right. And actually, I like this semantics better than the original one, right? Because it's more in tune with Kripke's semantics of logic. So we just, instead of adding to something that is relational a second component that is functional, we add a second component that is also relational. So this looks like the natural way to do it. And in fact, there are many logics that actually do interpret binary connectives that are sort of implications, like this one, using ternary relations. So this is, we're not the inventors of that idea.
This should be related to rational models of relevant logics.
Yeah,
What is happening with bifunctionality condition? Maybe you said it and I missed it.
Right. I haven't said anything about the bifunctionality. So what should I say? So if X is less than or equal to x prime. Okay, yeah, right, this is the part that gets dangerous, right? Then well, then we have these two sets here, and
this is ordinary monotonicity in just one coordinate. We're not trying to, because by functionality,
yeah, well,
functionality,
I mean,
was stated for both coordinates at the same time.
Yeah, but by transitivity of the less than relation,
and
I mean,
commutativity, right? Because it's commutative.
Yeah, right. I mean, okay. So it suffices to state it on one side, and it suffices to state it for one component only. If something is monotone in both arguments, then it's monotone in both arguments at the same time. So, I mean, there's anything wrong with that? No. It can, monotonicity is component-wise, or there's nothing wrong with that. Okay. Right, so we have to, of course, put this here, but then we have to say when a set is under another one. So I'll illicitly define this in a way that is as liberal as possible to make the soundness proof work, right? So let's just do the soundness proof and see what exact definition we need here, right?
I would start maybe even with proving simply that everything what was apart closed remains apart closed under this definition, right? So representation of phi and psi were apart closed, and the close of fusion and the close of magic wand also produces something apart closed.
Well, that's for magic for fusion it's trivial, right? Yes. For magic wand it's
this is what it is.
This is for magic wand it may not be quite that trivial. So okay, okay, let's do it. Okay, we reprove a lemma that we've proved previously, namely that the extension of every formula is up-closed. So, and we do this, fine. By induction over phi. And again, only in two cases does the argument change, because in all other cases, the definition of satisfaction stays exactly as before. The clause for star is precisely built in such a way as to make its semantics upwards closed, because we don't take just... That's precisely why we say not just when... We do not only say that everything that's produced by n times n prime satisfies the fusion, but also everything that's above it. Right. So that is trivial. So the only non-trivial part is this one. So let's do the clause for magic wand. Bearing in mind that we haven't yet defined what exactly this bifunctoriality means. Okay. What names can I use? V, maybe. So, we assume that we have something above... No, I want to call this V. So let's assume we have some V above M, and we have that M satisfies phi magic wand psi. We have to show that V also satisfies phi magic wand psi. So we give ourselves a state that satisfies phi, and moreover, second part of the universal quantifier, we give ourselves a state u to which m times n evaluates. Let's remind ourselves what we have to show. We have to show that u satisfies psi. Okay. Well, because m satisfies phi, magic wand psi, we have that whenever m times, whenever m times n evaluates to, wrong, not v, v is taken, u. Whenever m times n, there's too many letters, no, u is also taken. What letters do we have, actually?
How about that in primes?
Primes, I hate primes. U prime, okay, u prime. The reason I don't like primes in notation is that whenever you put a prime on something, it looks as if it's derived from what was there previously, and most of the time that's just not true. It's just another way to, just a way to obtain a second designator for something of the same type. So I don't like that at all. But yeah, okay. So let's go with u prime. Okay. And now we need to conclude this from monotonicity, right? So this here basically says. This here says that m times n is contained in the extension of psi, and we have to show that this part here basically says that what is my nomenclature? There was something wrong here, right? So this must be V. Okay. So. So we have to show that V times N is contained in the extension of psi. Okay. So now what we need is that. So V is above M. What we need is that everything in here, every such u, is above something to which m times n evaluates. So what we need is right? So we need that v times n is contained in the upwards closure of m times n. Right? Then we're done by induction hypothesis, because if m times n is contained in this extension, then by the inductive hypothesis, the upwards closure of m times n will also be contained in the extension of psi, because that is by induction hypothesis upwards closed. And if v times n is contained in that, then it will also be contained in the upwards closure of psi. So this is exactly what we need. So this now gives rise to our monotonicity condition, all right? We need that we need this to mean what? We need this to mean that the M was the smaller one, right? So this is the X. So this year is then, in by this calculation, this year should mean that x prime times y, so the larger element times y, is contained in the smaller element times y upwards closure. And this year translates equivalently into the following formula. If whenever x prime times y evaluates to u, then there exists a v to which x times y evaluates such that v is under u. Okay. Right. So, slightly more simply put, we're extending the ordering on the elements to an ordering on sets, saying that a set is above another set if and only if each of its elements is bounded from below by one of the elements on the left-hand side, which is a totally standard ordering on sets. Right. Okay, soundness. Right, of course, we only have to check those rules that are affected by the changed clauses, so we only have to check the rules for fusion and magic wand. What was the exact formulation of the soundness theorem? If a sequent is derivable and something satisfies the formula for the bunch, then it satisfies the formula on the right?
The way I studied it was that if a sequent is derivable, then in every model and under every valuation, the notation of the left-hand side is contained in the notation on the right-hand.
So every state that satisfies the denotation of the sequent, or that satisfies the sequent, the bunch, satisfies the conclusion, right? Okay, so. Let's call this one phi. Okay, right rule, right? For fusion. Okay, we're already assuming that these two sequents are valid. We have to show that the sequent down there is valid. We spent endless time on this, but never mind. Right, so. So I'll elide this conversion to formulas. I'll just say that something satisfies a sequent. So let M satisfy the combined sequent here from the conclusion. So now we just go into the semantic clause for satisfying this combined sequent, right? So this comma here is fusion. So this here means that we have this situation here, a product that evaluates to some u, where n satisfies gamma, n prime satisfies delta, and u is under n. Okay, what do we have to show? Then, By assumption, these two sequences are already valid, so n satisfies phi, n prime satisfies psi. And therefore, I can put them together and evaluate them to U, and U will, and then go upwards to M. And M then satisfies phi fusion psi. So phi, that's what I had to show, all right? That part went well. Let's do the left rule. So the left rule is obvious. It's not just obvious, it's actually trivial, because satisfying something that has a comma in there is by definition exactly the same as satisfying something where the comma is replaced by a fusion, because the comma means fusion. So there's absolutely nothing to show. So let's go to the right rule for magic wand. So we have that gamma comma psi phi entails psi, and then we conclude that gamma entails phi magic 1 psi. Okay. We let M satisfy gamma. We let n satisfy phi. We let m times n evaluate to u. It's a bit of pain about all the designators we need, but so far we have enough. And we have to show that u satisfies psi. Right, that's what we have to show in order to show that M satisfies this formula on the right. Okay. Okay, we have that U satisfies gamma comma phi because there exists something below it, namely U itself, to which M times N evaluates. And M satisfies gamma and N satisfies phi. So U satisfies gamma comma phi. Again, due to the fact that comma is the same as fusion. Okay, by the assumption that the premise is sound, we obtain that U satisfies psi. And that's what we're showing. I will actually dare to omit the other one. Because, I mean, this here pretty much showed that we defined the clauses in the right way. They play together in the exactly right fashion. Before I get stuck later, I'll just verify that everything is fine now. So let's do the left one as well. Need room. So magic wand left. Magic wand left is slightly more complicated, although not quite as complicated as stated in the book. So basically, it's this. Let's maybe write it this way. So if I have a delta that entails the premise to be phi, And in some context, the conclusion to be psi entails chi, then if I have in that same context delta multiplicatively combined with phi magic 1 psi, then this entails chi. Okay. Now, I didn't do the original version of the proof, obviously. Did you do induction over gamma? I probably would have come to think of it.
I introduced this intermediate notion of a function on upsets or induced by a bunch with a hole, and proved a few lemmas about it, and I was using it throughout the soundness proof.
Well, right. Okay, so I would probably do induction on gamma and for that, nothing, well, nearly nothing changes. Okay, something changes, namely the treatment of star, right? But we've already shown that everything works for star, for fusion, right? So, and for the semicolon, nothing's changed. So I'll pretend that gamma is the empty context, right? The only new thing should happen in the base case. And then, we're assuming that some state satisfies the combination of my context delta here and phi magic 1 psi. So we go into the semantics of the comma, which is fusion. So we have what? That n times n prime evaluates to U, where n satisfies delta, n prime satisfies phi magic 1 psi, and u is below n. By the assumption that the premises are sound, n satisfies phi, who manipulated the chalk? Therefore, because n prime satisfies phi magic 1 psi, n satisfies phi, and n prime and n times n prime evaluates to U, which is under m, it follows that it follows that m satisfies psi, and again by assumption, now for the second premise, right, now we're here, it follows that m satisfies chi. Okay, very nice. Right, so that's the sound. Okay, on to completeness. Here. Well. Here. What sort of bothers me is that we didn't need anywhere that this thing is associative, right? Well, I probably needed it implicitly because we kept re-bracketing things, right?
Yeah, when dealing with bunches and doing
things. Yeah, then we're probably.
We didn't use this notion of propositional collapse or whatever. I think that I would take an easy way out and simply show that there is a residuation node holds for upsets, and this gives you that you get a BA algebra, and at least that this would give us certainty that things work. But even then, you need to still show us.
Right. Everything's fine so far, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I think associativity might be used implicitly here by even making these. I mean, I think even making these clauses well defined might.
You know, you.
Well, making the semantics of a bunch well defined depends on associativity, right? So I calculate bunches modulo as associativity, and even making their semantics well defined will. Then require associativity of the underlying.
The rationalizations of residuated lattices and lambda calculus, which are not necessarily associative, and then you can still consider residuation law. So maybe it's just completely orthogonal. And maybe it's easier to obtain, the scalability results in absence, or complexity results in absence of associativity.
Yeah, it could be, right? Yeah, but one would certainly have to make the bunches non-associative in order to get some.
Yeah, and it could have to be reflected in. I mean, the comma should also not be associative.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Okay. So let's just say, okay, we will have used associativity somewhere implicitly in our treatment of bunches about which we assume that they are associative, right? Okay, now. And our completeness proof will start off with a model construction. So I haven't mentioned any sort of consistent formula here. Of course, consistency isn't even a is it? Well, it is a meaningful notion, but we're not going to use it. So the reason that I don't mention any particular formula or bunch here is that the model construction will just do everything in one go. Right? I'll construct a big model that provides witnesses. Counter witnesses to all non-derivable sequence. So what's a non-derivable sequence? Well, something of this form, right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, as we've done a few times, I'll just use this, the left-hand side here as positive properties of the nodes in our model. So basically, I'll just make these things the nodes in our model. So the nodes are going to be bunches, right? So the elements, states in our model are going to be bunches. And I'm going to build it in such a way that they all, every bunch satisfies exactly the formulas that it entails. And then, of course, I get immediately a witness, a counter witness to every non-derivable sequence. Now let us check what may happen, right? Of course, I cannot really use any old bunch. So I cannot even use any old formula. So for instance, this one. So it's completely clear that this formula cannot be a state in the model, at least not if I want the mentioned truth lemma to hold. Because, well, if it were to be a state in the model, then clearly it would have to satisfy this formula here, right? Well, which would mean, by the definition of satisfaction, that it would satisfy either A or B. But of course, let's say it satisfies A. A is not derivable from A or B, right? So that immediately would kill the whole idea, right? So this here apparently won't work. So we have to work on the bunches before we can include them as states in our model. That is not new, right? I mean, this happens in every logic with disjunction. It doesn't happen if you exclude disjunction, which is why I'm reasonably confident that I would have been able to prove this in about 15 minutes, because I can just use any bunch. I don't have to normalize bunches in any way whatsoever. right? If I don't have disjunction, then this problem disappears and I can just use all bunches as states in the model. So I'll have to somehow use bunches that don't have disjunction and that are also hopefully normalized in some other ways. What this means is, I'll just use our good old notion of saturation, right? I'll only use saturated bunches. What does saturated mean? Well, that means I use only those bunches where the L rules have been applied exhaustively. Well, careful, right? What does that mean? And it's clear in almost all cases, namely for all unary rules. I just say, okay, I apply my unary rule, and I do that for as long as possible. Every unary rule, and by unary I mean it has only one present premise, right? Every unary rule will destruct one connective, and after enough application of left rules for these, all my connectives will be destroyed and I'm done. The slightly more difficult cases are the binary rules, which are the ones for, among the left rules, there are only two binary rules. They are the ones for magic wand and for implication. So let's look again at the one for, have I wiped it? No, I haven't wiped it, have I? Oh, actually I did just, well, I haven't wiped the one for magic wand. So, let's reuse this here for the current argument. So what do I mean by exhaustively applying this left rule here? Of course, I get two premises now. One of them sort of removes the outer context and one keeps it. I'm interested in the side that keeps it. So by applying this rule backwards exhaustively, I mean remove all multiplicative contexts delta and all magic wands. For the case where this context that I remove derives the antecedent of my magic wand. So what this translates into is the following condition. Of the condition that gamma doesn't have a certain form, namely this one, which would be the one where I could apply my rule backwards, of course, under one additional condition, namely that the left branch that I get there in the proof search is successful. So, so I don't get any combination of this form here where this context delta here derives phi. And then there's the rule for implication. It's this one. Better look this up. So it looks rather similar. Did we use the additive version of this? We must have, right?
Additive version of what?
Of the implication left rule.
It was part of.
Yeah. Wait a minute. So this would be the one where. Does it have a semicolon here? Does it look like that?
You replace in that version is you replace colon with semicolon.
So wait a minute, isn't this one is that the correct wording?
Well you also use bunches with holes in the formulation.
Ah, right, we have a context here around this whole thing. So we have the... is that really necessary? Because this is nearly additive. Yeah, that was the other... And this is more or less the multiplicative version, right? Oh, well, never mind. Okay, so it's like this. Yeah. Like this. Yeah. Right, so the...
Sorry? Separate gammas in here.
No, not in the additive version of the rule. It's the same gamma, right? Did I copy this correctly? This should be exactly what's on the board now.
This wasn't the original form of the
A. I wanted this variant here, right? So, okay, again, so basically this is the same condition. If gamma derives phi and I get a combination like this, then I basically unpack the psi that I get. Except in this case, I have to keep in mind that I can duplicate this formula here. So this formula could have another copy that I push into the gamma. And then it survives here. So I get the same phenomenon as we had in intuitionistic logic.
In the general version of the implication rule, the two gammas in the premise are different.
Yeah, but this one was derived, and I'm pretty sure it derives the other version with the different gammas because I can do weakening. And this is the form that we want here, I believe. So essentially what happens is we keep the implication in the bunch, we just add its conclusion. That of course spoils termination, as in the intuitionistic case. So what we do is we mark this formula here as soon as we've applied this left rule for implication two at once. All right? We don't do this several times. Every time we do that, we're going to just get the copy of psi, and when we proceed upwards along this branch, then all we'll ever get here is going to be at least as strong as the psi that we already got out of this. All right? Okay. So that's what I mean by saturated bunches. And now we have to, before we delve into what the ordering is, or the pre-ordering, we have to start thinking about what our monad operation is going to be. And, well, there's a tiny problem here. This here is a saturated bunch. No rule is going to apply to it. In order to apply, saturated means if I make this the left side of a sequent, I'm not going to be able to apply any rules, right? So if no left rule is going to apply to this, because in order to apply the left rule for magic wand, the antecedent would have to be provable for something in the multiplicative context, so this would have, in this case, well, there is no multiplicative context, so I can take the empty one. And the empty multiplicative context doesn't derive A, which would mean that A is a theorem. Of course, some arbitrary propositional atom is not a theorem. So this here is saturated. Same here. I mean, this is even more saturated. Obviously, no left rule applies to this thing. Okay. Times is obviously going to be common, right? Now, this here is no longer saturated. Because now, I can apply this rule here, right? I have a multiplicative context, delta, namely this A here, which derives A by the Axing rule. So now, this here would saturate to B or C. Well, B or C isn't saturated, so now I have to saturate further. Of course, I could saturate this either to B, or to C? I have no way of knowing which. And this kind of example is actually why I believe that a deterministic interpretation of the monoid operation should be morally impossible. I don't see how to resolve this, honestly. This will always happen, right? And even if I don't necessarily plan on... I can think of additional ideas, and if I look at the labeled calculus that you find in Galmiche, etc., right, then I haven't actually looked at it, but I would sort of expect that the labels that you generate are a free monoid, right? Free commutative monoid. But even that, right? I mean, I would have to multiply two bunches that have certain labels, right? Formula sets. And I would have to multiply these two things. And this thing here, I mean, just is non-deterministic. It evaluates morally to B and to C. And I don't see how to pick any of those two. So, yeah, like I said, I'm not making any claims here, and I will have to look at the construction. It just seems fairly obvious that, this non-deterministic idea of evaluating this monoid product here to both these bunches is at least the natural thing to do. Okay. Right. Right, so let's introduce some notation. This bunch rewriting basically so I write gamma evolves to gamma prime if gamma prime arises from gamma by one L rule. Evolves or actually evaluates is a nice term. Following my marking discipline, of course, always. And as usual, I denote the transitive reflexive closure of that thing by this wiggly arrow star. So this here means evolves by or evaluates by zero or several L rules. Okay, now I can define my non-deterministic multiplication of two saturated bunches. So I'll take this to be the set of all saturated bunches theta. Such that gamma, delta evaluates in possibly several steps to theta. So, in particular, following our above example, if I take this bunch here and this bunch, then the result is this, where, well, the comma is meant to be enumeration of elements of a set, so it's one bunch B and one bunch containing only C. Right. I'm not going to check that this is actually associative, A, because associativity doesn't seem to be so central, and B, it's because it seems fairly obvious because the comma operation is associative, right? So that should be hopefully fairly clear. I have to say what the neutral element is. And the neutral element is just going to be the empty multiplicative bunch. You have to say what my ordering is. So when is gamma less than or equal to delta? Well, the ordering should be determined by the semicolon. Right? The semicolon gives me a joint semilattice structure, because it's idempotent and associative and commutative, and I can immediately derive the ordering from it. So basically, well, basically this means that there should exist a theta such that gamma composed additively with theta gives me delta. But of course, this here might not be saturated because I might have implications in here that get their antecedent from gamma. So I have to evaluate. Possibly iterate. All right. I would now morally have to check that my multiplication here is monotone in that sense, right? How easy is that? Well, I would have to check that this set of saturated bunches, gamma times gamma prime, is below the set gamma times gamma prime, delta times gamma prime. Okay, let's just do it. I'm running out of letters for bunches. It's a good letter for a bunch, psi. Capital psi. I'm sorry, I mean, what can I do? right, so this would be an element of this thing here, a star actually here. This would be an element of the right-hand side. I have to show that it's above something on the left-hand side. And that's, this should be clear. So I have that so I have that gamma semicolon theta evaluates to delta, right? That was my assumption. It follows that, I mean, the same thing will obviously work if I add something multiplicatively, so so if I add the gamma prime to it multiplicatively, then this will evaluate to delta gamma prime. I mean, this might not be saturated, but still the reduction steps will work. And do I have to show anymore even? So wait, I need an element of this thing here.
so I want something.
No, this here is wrong, right? So this is also copied from the old definition. So this isn't good enough. So to be fair, there's an erratum on this. Actually what the erratum says is I should put this if and only if the propositional collapse of gamma entails the one of delta. This here is obviously more special. What I was trying to do here is let's do at the same time a semantic cat elimination proof, which is maybe overzealous. But what we see here is that this is not enough. This here might happen somewhere deep down in a bunch. So I might add something with a semicolon somewhere deep down in a bunch. And because the multiplication should be monotone, this will then also increase the bunch if I do it deep down somewhere. So this here becomes more complicated. Now I shouldn't say gamma prime, right? Well, can't double prime, never mind. So I have gamma and delta is also taken. What else do we have? So we call this guy theta prime. This here we call theta. So if gamma is of this form, gamma double prime with theta sitting somewhere, and then we can additively insert the theta prime here, getting something stronger, additively stronger, and this should evaluate to delta. Okay. Right. And then, now with this definition, it should be obvious that the multiplication is monotone because that's how I constructed the thing, right? This here means I construct this here to be monotone. And what this means here is that in this case, so if I have delta arising in that way, then I need to show that, well, actually what I need is that gamma paired with something here evaluates to something that is below this here. And then, of course, if it evaluates further, then it's also below this one. So this here, and okay, gamma double prime theta, and then something from gamma prime, well, gamma prime itself, of course. So this should evaluate to all right, and then of course we insert the theta prime here. This evaluates to delta, comma, gamma prime. And this evaluates further to psi, oof, which is what we had to show, if somebody's still following me. no. Okay, so let's clean this up. I've been taking an element from the right-hand side, and I want to show that this element on the right-hand side is above something from the left-hand side. So this element from the right-hand side must be something such that delta, comma, gamma prime evaluates to it, psi. Okay, I need this psi to be above something to which gamma times gamma prime evaluates. Above means I can insert the theta prime here into gamma, which is of the form gamma double prime theta. So I insert it in the same place. So this larger thing evaluates to delta comma gamma prime, which further evaluates to psi. Fine, right? So psi is above this thing here. Good. Right, so this proves that my monoid is at least a legal object, right? So the model that I've constructed is actually a model. And now what we have to do... Yeah, I guess now we can go here. So we are finished with the model construction. We have the model. Now we have to show that it does what it's supposed to, that is, we prove a truth lemma. So the next pain in the whole development is to figure out what exactly the truth lemma should say. Okay, according to my most recent insights, the truth lemma should say this. The truth lemma would tell me something about an equivalence, right? So the truth lemma tells me every state, so every bunch, satisfies exactly the formulas that it entails, except that one word it's slightly different. So first of all, if gamma, a saturated bunch as a state in the model, satisfies the formula phi, then gamma derives this formula, phi. So far, so good. And the painful bit is the other way around. And the formulation, I believe that's the correct one, is this. Namely, gamma satisfies its own propositional collapse. Well, that is what we expect, except that on the way, we will need something different, which, however, seems to follow. So what I need is the converse of what? Namely, if gamma derives phi, then gamma satisfies phi as a state in the model. But This should follow by SanDisk. Right? If it is derivable, if phi is derivable from gamma, and I have a state that actually satisfies the propositional collapse of gamma, then that state, by the soundness theorem, satisfies also phi. That is the soundness theorem. Right? So I'm hoping to be on the safe side here. So no immediate problems that jump off the board. So one is actually fairly easy. So one is by induction on phi.
Phi gamma thing is what I call propositional collapse, and the node with a big conjunction sign.
Big conjunction sign.
Big conjunction sign. Conjunction of gamma.
Yeah, it's meant to be the. But I mean, that's not good notation, right? Because it concerns multiplication too. I mean, I've seen it denoted phi gamma elsewhere. I mean, in particular, Tim writes phi gamma, I think.
Yeah, but what he denotes phi gamma, I don't know whatever.
Okay, so this is phi gamma is the propositional collapse of gamma, where I replace every comma with fusion and every semicolon with and. And empty context by, and multiplicative empty context by I, and the additive empty context by true. Right? Okay. And I'm claiming I can do this by induction on phi. So let's, we have like 6 minutes, so let's do maybe only a few cases. Let's say M satisfies a fusion. There. Well, we know our semantics. That is, we have states n and n prime whose product evaluates to u such that n satisfies phi, n prime satisfies psi. And of course, u is under, m isn't very good. Gamma. Now, of course, I'm running out of names. Gamma 1, gamma 2, delta, gamma 1, gamma 2, delta, gamma. Okay. Right. This here implies, by the inductive hypothesis, that gamma 1 derives phi. I'm omitting the entails sign in the beginning. And gamma 2 derives psi. And my rules tell me that then gamma 1 comma gamma 2 derives phi fusion psi. And now delta is something to which this evaluates, so it's stronger. And gamma is even above it, so gamma will also derive this. Okay, I'm putting in a lemma that I haven't stated and proved, that basically whenever I evaluate a bunch, then whatever I evaluate it to is a bunch that derives more, or at least as much, as the original one. Okay, and the other cases are similar. No difficulties here. I mean, at least I've done all the cases earlier this afternoon, and they all worked. Now comes the daring bit, right? Number 2 in 3 minutes. Of course, we're not going to be able to do it completely. This I plan to prove by induction over gamma. And, well, So I'm not going to say that semicolon and comma are trivial, but they are going to work exactly as further cases that we get below, namely the ones for conjunction and comma and fusion. Right? So I mean, they're just syntactic variants of these, basically. So the key bit is the case where gamma is an actual formula. Well, that's not quite fair, because gamma is... was this the way I wanted to word this? Or I changed this back a few times, back and forth, so I wonder if this is really the correct wording. No, actually, it's stricter. So it's, I want to prove something stricter, namely that if gamma prime evaluates to gamma, then gamma satisfies phi gamma prime, and the induction is also more complicated. So the induction is on this reduction and on gamma. Okay, so but nevertheless, the cases for semicolon and comma are going to appear elsewhere anyway, so we ignore them. And we have maybe time to do one case from this reduction bit, right? So if I say I do reduction over both, then I say what I actually mean is I do this in lexical ordering. So I have an outer induction over this and then over the reduction relation and or evaluation relation, and I have an inner induction over this gamma that I end up with. So one. One case that I get is this one, for instance, right? So I evaluate gamma prime with delta, comma, phi, magic 1 psi, somewhere deep inside, where delta derives phi. That's my proviso for this reduction here. Otherwise, I don't do it. And this here then further evaluates to gamma. Okay. So no, more precisely, I now do my inner induction over gamma prime. And I forget about all the steps. And the interesting bit is, in this case, the induction base. So by the induction hypothesis, this here already works, right? So the step from here to here. So gamma actually satisfies psi, because there's nothing more to collapse propositionally. Okay, and then I have to show that gamma satisfies also this other bit, and this was slightly involved. And parse what I wrote here.
God, I've got this.
Yeah, I'm trying to decompose this, right? But somehow I don't. I mean, here I just claim I can do it. I saw it this afternoon. I don't see it currently, I must say. So, yeah, we're 4 minutes over, so yeah, I wouldn't have managed the whole thing anyway. So maybe it can be taken up as a challenge. So, of course, there's a simple example which would look like this, right? So, this thing here would evaluate to B. Right, this is a saturated bunch, and I mean, by rights, this thing should satisfy this formula here, right? Or at least this bunch. Just can't, for all the world of it, make out Y for the moment. Ah, wait a minute. It can be. Ah, right. Of course. So it suffices. I don't actually have to decompose this thing. That's the point. I don't have to decompose this thing. I just have to find something under it that decomposes. This here is under it. This obviously decomposes in the way that I want. Right. So that discharges this case here. Right. Because that's my clause, which thankfully I. Was going to say didn't wipe, but of course did wipe a few moments ago. So what the clause, as we already know it, right, also in the standard case, says for the comma, which is the same as fusion, the clause for fusion says I find something under my current state that decomposes as a product. Each of the and the components satisfy these bits here. So under B, and the same of course here under psi or under something that satisfies psi. I find something that I find this here, which decomposes into A and A magic wand B, each of which, of course, by induction will satisfy what it says. So this thing here will actually satisfy A, this will satisfy A magic wand B, and that's it, right? So that's this case discharged. Then there's the other cases for evaluating only one of which is non-trivial. That's the one for implication, all the other ones are trivial. And then I finally have to do induction over the final gamma, which will take more time than we have now. I give no guarantees that this actually works, right? But it looks good. Okay. And Pim said it looked good as well. So, right, any questions? Okay. I should make two announcements while I still have your attention, which I maybe don't. We have two elective lectures next semester, semantics of programming language, or actually practical semantics of programming languages. That's a course held by Tadeusz, right? And it is concerned with implementing the semantics of programming languages in a theorem prover, COC to be precise.
Prover system.
Well, yeah, it's still called a theorem prover, isn't it? An interactive theorem prover, yeah. So you have to do work. You don't just enter the formulas, you also have to do the proofs. And then there's a second course that we just decided to do recently because one of our guys unexpectedly got his position extended. That's a course on modal logic, so part of which we've done here, we've done S4 basically, right, and K. This is more extensive. It does only modal logic. It also goes beyond just mere sequence systems. It talks about canonical models. It does all the stuff that you standardly do in modal logic and that we haven't done here. It's a huge field. It will work with a well-written book, most of which is correct as far as I can tell. That's the so-called blue book, so the book Modal Logic by Blackburn, De Rijke, and Venema. All very reliable guys, so you should basically take your pick from these two lectures or actually go to both of them. The other bit that I was going to announce is this one. We need tutors for theory of programming. Don't worry if you haven't taken the course. There's a well-developed script, and if you can do this, then you can do that as a tutor. So it's a basic course, right, with lots of not so eager people in it. So there's no danger that the students will overtake you. So no worry about the difficulty of this course. And like I said, there's a good block of well-developed reading material that tells you exactly what's in the course. So please apply now. Thank you.